This is the tax update for July 14, 2008. This week, getting started automatically, the IRS modifies rules for startup and organizational expenditures. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a continuing education presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. This week, the IRS issued temporary regulations under Section 195, 248, and 709, provisions that were modified by the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004 back in October of that year. However, the major change we're going to find in each of these new proposed regulations, or I should say temporary regulations, is not related to the law change that Congress made back in 2004, but rather a significant change that deals with what used to be a significant trap that practitioners or taxpayers ran into when dealing with these types of expenses. The new rules are officially effective for expenses incurred or paid after September 8th of 2008, but taxpayers can elect to use the new rules for any period after the effective date of the 2004 Act that is still open for the assessment of tax. Now, these provisions of the tax law generally impact new enterprises, new entities, new ventures. Section 195 governs startup expenditures for any type of entity. Section 248 governs corporate organization costs. And Section 709 governs partnership organization and syndication costs. The general rule is that such expenses are by default, at least per the code, capitalized and not available for amortization. But with the proper election, the startup expenses, the corporate organization costs, and the partnership organization but not syndication costs can be expensed or amortized under general rules that are applied independently for each type of cost. As you'll note, taxpayers may expense up to $5,000 of such expenditures, though we can lose that ability down the line if we incur too much in the way of these costs. Any expenses after $5,000 have been incurred must be capitalized and then amortized over 180 months. And if the expenses incurred exceed $50,000 for the specific type of expense, the $5,000 expensing amount must be reduced dollar for dollar for each dollar in excess of $50,000. Thus, expensing is entirely eliminated if more than $55,000 of a particular type of cost is incurred, one of the three categories. Now, each of the three categories stands alone, so we don't worry about the fact that in total, if we had both startup costs and corporate organization costs, that in total they exceed $50,000. What we do worry about is that each specific type of cost, we look inside that type of cost and determine if the costs incurred exceed $50,000 or $55,000 when we start losing our ability to write off the initial $5,000 of such costs. Startup costs for a new enterprise are governed by Section 195, and let's review that provision and the other provisions before we get into the regulations and their changes. Section 195 starts out with the following general provision. Under A, it tells us that except as otherwise provided in the section, no deduction is allowed for startup expenditures. So the general rule is no deduction for startup expenditures is allowed. Nor is there any provision made here to amortize or do anything else with the expenditures. They just become permanently capitalized until we can get rid of the business. However, there is an alternative defined under B where we're given an election to deduct. And B1 tells us that if we elect the application of this subsection with respect to any startup expenditures, then we get the $5,000, $50,000, $55,000 test that I talked about just before. Now, it goes on to tell us that if we dispose of the trade or business before the end of the amortization period, Any deferred expenses subject which were not deducted by reason of this section may be deducted to the extent allowed under 165. So we write off the balance in the year in which we totally dispose of that trade or business. So that's our method for recovering the expenses under the alternative method. Now, a key question becomes for startup expenses, just what are they? And Section 195C provides us with that and tells us that a startup expenditure means any amount paid or incurred in connection with investigating the creation or acquisition of an active trade or business, or creating an active trade or business, or any activity engaged in for profit and for the production of income before the day on which the active trade or business begins in anticipation of such activity becoming an active trade or business, and which, if paid or incurred with connection with the operation of an existing trade or business in the same field of the trade or business as we started with, would be allowed as a deduction for the taxable year in which paid or incurred. Now, the term startup expenditure specifically excludes deductions under Section 163A, which relates to interest, Section 164, which relates to taxes, and research and development expenditures under Section 174. They are governed by the standard rules and are not captured as startup expenditures. The other key issue is, what's the beginning of a trade or business? And Section 195C2 goes on to tell us that, in general, termination when of active trade or business begins shall be made in accordance with the regulations as the Secretary may prescribe, except for B, if we have an acquired trade or business which we purchased, shall be treated as beginning when the taxpayer acquires it. Now, it generally becomes a kind of facts and circumstances test to determine when we are active and available for business, but usually open and available to receive and available to actually earn money and actually start doing what we're supposed to do is a key point for determining when we have started our trade or business. Finally, under 195D, we look at the issue of how we make our election. And D1 tells us that the election must be made no later than the time prescribed by law for filing the return for the taxable year in which the trade or business begins, including the extensions thereof. Now, quite a while back, we had a podcast where we talked about the ability to get waivers of missing dates for filing certain elections. And one key factor in those regulations that we discussed is that if a deadline is set by statute, the IRS takes the position that they have no authority to weigh or to extend that statutory period beyond at least the period for the extended due date of the return. What that means is, if you failed to make the election, you couldn't get IRS relief down the line. Significant issue under 195. And D2 tells us that the period selected under B shall be adhered to in computing taxable income for the taxable year in which the election is made and all subsequent taxable years. So once we make the election, it's irrevocable. We have to live with that period, live with the election and the method from that point forward. Now, as we'll discover, the IRS is going to introduce to us a rather unique way of making this election. But previously, we had to make it on paper with the return for the year in which the business began, where we would start the amortization period. That previously created a bit of a trap for the unwary, because the IRS would take the position that, in fact, you had to do a couple of things. You had to identify the expenses that were your startup expenses, and then you had to elect to amortize them. Well, taxpayers had a real tendency to be very narrowly focused in determining what were startup expenditures, because obviously full expensing, especially if we have more than a minimal amount of expenses, is preferable to recovering them over 180 months. As such, they tended to leave them off and claimed regular deductions. The IRS position is, down the line, if it was determined that an expenditure was actually a startup expenditure which a taxpayer had not put on the election form, and which they had written off an expense, the IRS position was that essentially that was capitalized because you had failed to elect with regard to that expense to amortize it over the applicable period. As we will note, the new regulations change that entirely. Now, corporate organization costs are covered by Section 248, and that provision is structured a little differently than the 195 provision, in that the default treatment of capitalization is implied rather than explicitly mentioned in the provision. It starts out with Section 248A, and that tells us that if a corporation elects the application of this subsection with respect to any organizational expenses, The corporation shall be allowed a deduction equal to, and now we get down to the $5,000, $50,000, $55,000 rule again. The definition of organization expenses is found at 248B, and that means an expenditure which is incident to the creation of the corporation, is chargeable to a capital account, and which is of a character which, if expended incident to the creation of a corporation having a limited life, would be amortized over such life. Generally, the expenses of organizing the entity and getting the entity as an entity up and running. Now, as with Section 195, the code provides a description of the election and again places a hard date on the date the election must be made by, the extended due date for the return in question. That is found in Section 248C. Similar issues arose here where taxpayers wanted to take legal fees, quite often would be the key issue here, and try to move them into current operations as opposed to organizational fees, again, preferable to write them off instantly than to have them recover them over 180 months. Again, the IRS position would generally be if you had not identified those expenses and elected to write them off over the amortization period, you were stuck with permanent capitalization. As noted, the regs are going to change how this works. They're not going to necessarily make it super simple where everything just works and we can ignore these provisions, but what it does mean is that it's not going to be the big disaster that it used to be if the IRS comes in down the line and discovers taxpayers had misidentified expenses, nor will it be such a big disaster if you inherit a client that you discover never got the advice initially to make the election for startup expenditures, has deducted a bunch of them, and now they're in exam with the IRS, and you've got that case of a couple of years back now where you've got expenses that no election was made and we're just in trouble on. Now, Section 709 for partnership governs both organization and syndication fees, but only the organization fees are potentially deductible and amortizable. It's structured more like Section 195, beginning with the explicit requirement to statement that you must capitalize these expenditures. And that tells us that, except as noted in the election section that follows, no deduction shall be allowed under this chapter to the partnership to any partners for amounts paid or incurred to organize a partnership or to promote the sale or to sell an interest in such partnership. Now, the first description there before the or, the amounts paid or incurred to organize a partnership, is the organization fees for which we can have an amortization election under Section 709B. The second half of those, the expenses incurred to promote the sale of or to sell an interest in such a partnership, those are the syndication costs. Syndication costs are not subject to the election to amortize over 180 months. They are not subject to any ability to amortize. They're going to be capitalized at the partnership level. They impact the basis of the partner, and they become an item of recovery on liquidation at the partner level, but not the partnership. B tells us our deduction, and again says we can, again, one more time make an election of some sort to be described later, and we get the $5,000, $50,000, $55,000 set of tests for dealing with the expenses. And it tells us again under B2 that if we dispose of the, if the partnership is liquidated before the end of the period to which that 1B applies, any deferred expenses which are not allowed as deduction by the reason of that section may be deducted to the extent allowed under 165. Syndication fees still get stuck with being capitalized, but organization costs are eligible to be amortized. The definition of partnership organization expenses is found in 709B3. And it tells us the organization expenses to which paragraph 1 applies are expenditures which are incident to the creation of the partnership, are chargeable to the capital account, and are of a character which, if expended incident to the creation of a partnership having an ascertainable life, would be amortized over such life. Again, very similar definition to what we saw to corporate organization costs. Again, the same bias and problem hit us in the past that taxpayers would prefer to find some way that these legal fees related to anything but the formation of the partnership so that they can get a current deduction. And on exam, the IRS might try to reclassify and then make the statement that those fees you had not, you had not specifically identified as organization costs, but which were organization costs, do not have a valid election to amortize. Therefore, they're stuck in the same category as your syndication costs. Into all of this, we have the new regulations that came down last week. The new regulations now make the default a presumed election to expense or amortize the costs in each of the three cases. But errors will still create some issues, though different ones for taxpayers. Let's first start with the Section 195 temporary regulation. Temporary regulation 1.195-1T starts out with a general provision that explains the basic rules for the 550-55,000 rule. But Section 1.195-1TB is what really gives us something useful, which is a presumption that election is made unless the taxpayers go out of their way to indicate they do not want to make this election. The first part of that part of the regulation tells us that we're deemed to have made the election under 195B to amortize startup expenditures for the taxpayer in which the trade or business to which the expenditures relates begin. It tells us we may elect choose to forego the deemed election by clearly electing to capitalize. So in what's a little bit of a tortured way of looking at it, we end up not electing, or we end up unelecting, shall we say, or doing what previously was the default if we did nothing. Now we have to elect to do what the code says is the default, and we automatically get an election presumed to be made for what the code tells us we had to elect. So aside from the fact that it seems to be different than the way Congress might have expected it to run, at least the way they originally wrote it, I don't think Congress will object to this too much at this point in time, but it is a different construct and a bit of a liberalization that we're seeing from the service on this matter. It tells us, again, the election to either amortize startup expenditures under Section 195B or capitalize is irrevocable and applies to all startup expenditures that are related to the active trade or business. So we automatically get the election, our deemed election, if we do nothing. A taxpayer who is totally ignorant, didn't come to you, and has started their business and has startup expenditures, is presumed to have elected to amortize those expenses. If they had up to $5,000 of expensing, amortization for amounts in excess of that, and potentially if we get above $55,000, amortization of everything, we're going to lose the five. That's the presumption that has been made. But what if our ignorant taxpayer, who obviously didn't know about this 195 provision, goes ahead and simply deducts the expenses, as they often will? TurboTax asks them about expenses they paid, they filled it in, and they're doing their return on TurboTax very nicely. Well, in this case, we have an error when the IRS comes in and examines the return. We've got a problem. But the IRS, and I probably use the wrong term there, it shouldn't be an error. The IRS views this differently. It says that a change in characterization of an item as a startup expenditure is a change in the method of accounting, to which Section 446 and 481A applies, if the taxpayer treated the item consistently for two or more taxable years. A change in termination of taxpayer in which the trade or business begins also is treated as a method of accounting if the taxpayer amortized startup expenditures for two or more taxable years. It means that errors in this area now, issues when the agent comes in, are treated as accounting method changes. If a single year is involved, you can still go back and amend until you file the second year. After you file the second year, we go from an error, which was what it was the first year, to a method of accounting, which is what it becomes the second. As a method of accounting, we must have the IRS's permission to change that method. However, on exam, the IRS is allowed to change the taxpayer or force the taxpayer to change from an impermissible to a permissible method. Section 481A provides a cumulative effect adjustment, essentially, that goes back and deals with the fact that the year in which the real error took place may be closed. That's irrelevant. We will, in the year of change, pick up the cumulative effect of the change. Now, taxpayers using an impermissible method of accounting generally can obtain the IRS's consent to use a permissible method by asking for that consent to be obtained, and you study the revenue rulings in place. Whether the IRS will give us simplified automatic procedures to fix this problem is an open question. My guess is, in most cases, except those where a taxpayer simply had no clue they needed to do this, the issue most often will arise on exam, not something you're going to often see corrected down the line or corrected in a later year by a taxpayer voluntarily changing their method. But still, it would seem the IRS should offer the voluntary option, or may offer it, especially for those cases, which we know we run into, where we inherit a client that simply had no clue the issue was even there, and now we need to go back and fix something. Now, we get a number of examples in each of these regulations to show us how these will work. Example 3 goes through in this regulation, under 195, goes through the mischaracterization. And it tells us that Corporation X determines in 2011 that Corporation X incurred $10,000 for additional startup expenses erroneously deducted in 2009 under Section 162 as a business expense. We charged off the expense. Under paragraph B, the corporation is deemed to have elected to have amortized those expenses. And presumably, that includes the additional $10,000 of expenses that were misclassified. Now, it's using an impermissible method of accounting for additional $10,000 because it's now gone more than 1 year. It's gone 2 years filing before the problem was noticed. And it must change its method under Section 1.446-1E and the administrative procedures in effect in the year in which the taxpayer discovers the problem and petitions the IRS to make a change of method. Don't forget, we have to have the IRS permission to change, at least officially, to do this. However, with permission, the 481 adjustment goes in the process to fix everything. Remember as well that if we have an examination, an IRS agent pretty much gets to pick and choose the year that we're going to make the change, although generally it's going to be the earliest open year is the year in which the IRS will attempt to make the change. That quite often has the most bang for the buck because in this particular case, we're going to bring an item into income that year because we previously had deducted it. And since it comes into income beginning 3 years earlier, that gives us the largest amount of interest that can be collected by the service on that understatement of tax. Now, example 4 goes through the similar result if we get the year of starting business wrong. And it tells us that again, the same set of facts that you'll see in example 2 in the regs, except that in 2010, it deducted startup expenditures allocated January through December of 2010. In addition, in 2011, it is determined that it actually began business in 2010. It's deemed to have elected to deduct its startup expenses in 2010. It impermissibly deducted startup expenses 2009 under the facts going back to number 9 in this case, and incorrectly determined the startup expenditures 2010. Therefore, it's using an impermissible method of accounting for startup expenditures and must change its method under Section 1.446-1E and the administrative procedures in place in the year in which they're making this change. Again, we have to go through the accounting method treatment, the 3115, as governed by the current administrative provisions to request a change in accounting method. Now, the effective date of this regulation, which is reproduced in our materials on page 9, gives the option to retroactively use these regulations and requires their use for expenses paid or incurred after September 8th of this year. To quote from the section, this section applies to startup expenditures paid or incurred after September 8, 2008. However, taxpayers may apply all provisions of this section to startup expenditures paid or incurred after October 22, 2004, provided that the period of limitations on assessment of tax for the year the election under paragraph B of this section is deemed to have been made has not expired. Otherwise, for startup expenditures paid or incurred prior to September 8 of 2008, see Section 1.195-1 effect prior to that date, the old version of the regulation before the temporary regulations came in to replace it. The practical matter of that is if you're in an exam with an agent who is raising this issue for a taxpayer for expenses incurred after 2004, now you can come back and use these temporary regulations as a basis for negotiating a correction that will have a change of accounting method in the earliest open year, but will not result in total disallowance forever to the taxpayer of these deductions. Most likely, if we have an exam at this point where the agent's raising the issue, the taxpayer in question, most likely we're looking at the year they did form as the one under exam or the year in which they started up. To make it a real problem, the IRS has to be dealing with a year, that particular year they took the expense. Now realize going forward, that won't be the case. As an impermissible method, the IRS will be able to reach back beyond the close of the statute of limitations. So until we get at to the end of the 180-month period 15 years later, if we have inappropriately deducted startup expenditures, or if we got our year of start wrong, the IRS can recover at least something related to that aggressive position until all of the expenses would have properly flowed through to income under the deemed election. Now, Section 248 has very similar rules to the 195 temporary regulations. Temporary Regulation 1.248-1TC provides us with the time and manner of making the election, and again, same basic rules. Presumptively, all expenses are covered by the election. A corporation that doesn't want to do that can elect to forego by attaching a paper election to the return. As well, if we expense something that we shouldn't have expensed because it was an organizational cost, it will fall under the presumptive election or the actual election, whichever one we had made. I don't know a whole lot of taxpayers are going to make the election to capitalize these costs, but if you did, then any cost that's later identified as organization would go into that capitalized account. And a change determination of taxable year in which it begins business is also treated as a change in method. So again, the accounting method changes come into play. Example 3 under these regulations, very similar to Example 3 under the Section 195 temporary regulation, tells us that a change in characterization of an item is a change in method. The change of accounting method rules apply. And Example 4 gives us a similar result for a determination of the year in which these things happen. Effective dates, same set of rules. After September 8th, required to use these provisions. Before September 8th, we can electively use these provisions, or we can go with the old section. Now remember, when we electively use these provisions, the one danger is that if there are any misidentified expenses, they're automatically yanked in. And the IRS still has access to those expenses beyond the close of the statute on the year in which that misclassification took place. However, if you don't elect these provisions and the IRS examines that year, then a different result, different problem. Same sort of issue. Finally, we go to the third code section that's impacted, and we have temporary regs under 709. Again, the 709 temporary regulations don't change the syndication cost issue. Those are still not amortizable. But we do, like with the startup expenditures and like with the corporate organization expenditures, get an automatic deemed election to amortize or expense these items as appropriate. If we don't want to do that, we have to explicitly file an election with the return stating that we are electing to capitalize those expenditures. Misclassified expenditures or starting in the wrong year is again an accounting method issue if we're beyond the if we have done it for 2 years. If we don't catch the error in the year following the year in which we make it, we have adopted an accounting method, and therefore the accounting method change rules would now apply. Now, since this IRC section covers more than just organization costs, it also reminds us that while we can write off unamortized organization costs on liquidation, syndication costs get a different treatment. And if you go ahead and read that provision at B3, it tells us if there is winding up and complete liquidation of partnership prior to the end of the amortization period, the unamortized amount of organization periods is a partnership deduction as final taxable year as provided in 165. However, there is no partnership deduction with respect to its capitalized syndication expenses. Similar set of examples, the paired examples 3 and 4, again are duplicated under these rules with the same results as we found for organization costs and for startup expenditures, for corporate organization costs, I should say. And the same set of effective dates and elective effective dates come into play under these provisions. Now, conclusion about this. Overall, this is probably taxpayer friendly compared to what we had before when the IRS was essentially open if they examined the year in which the organization costs were claimed as a deduction to get them never deductible. But remember, they also give us an exposure down the line, because so long as we still have items out there and we still have the 15-year period for recovery running, the IRS can still go and reach back and pick up what would be the unamortized part of the deduction and pick up and give and create a tax liability for that unamortized part effective in the earliest open year. So initially, it's going to be good news for taxpayers because it's going to eliminate the problem we had before. Down the line, though, it gives the IRS the right to continue raising these questions all the way through the 15-year period. Obviously, if we're at year 14, we have much less concern with the IRS raising this issue than we may have in year 4, when now the IRS previously couldn't really reach that deduction in error because the theory is, well, it should have been capitalized, but we're not going to get credit for capitalizing it, and the IRS can't recover the tax, so just tough luck. Now, in fact, the IRS can go back and actually recover what has been the amount that has not yet been properly recovered. As well, if you do make the election to capitalize, now the IRS can go back as long as the entity is around or as long as the business continues to be owned and find expenses in that first year to add to the capitalized amount. I should add that generally, if in fact we were making that election, there is some reason why we didn't want expenses in that year. It seems more likely in that particular case that the IRS might be more concerned down the line with us attempting to use that as basis when the item is sold, and we're going to try to claim that as current basis rather than lost, than some expense that got burned up with an expired NOL from years before. So in that case, we probably have less worry about the IRS going back to find such expenses for us. Now, why did the IRS do this? Well, in the preamble to the temporary regulations, they give the basic justification as saying that basically they're starting out to tell us the first reason they changed it is because of electronic filing. This was one of those elections, and as you know, if you do any electronic filing, elections, especially ones that are defined by regulation, become a real pain to work with in the electronic filing system. The IRS has decided, why don't we just get rid of this election? Because it goes on to tell us that they acknowledge the vast majority of taxpayers that incur costs that may be deducted under these sections elect to deduct those costs, at least unless they're totally unaware they have to do so. Finally, the IRS notes in passing that the change reduces the administrative burden of these elections. Please remember, these are temporary regulations. They do have an expiration date attached to them. That suggests the IRS is looking at potentially revising the concept, because interestingly enough, they did not issue proposed regulations at the same time. So that suggests this may be somewhat of a trial balloon for the IRS. They want to do it this way, and they're giving it right now and putting it forward, but they're not yet convinced enough to believe that this is really where we'd like to go, at least not so convinced that they're willing to push these out as proposed regulations to move forward on those from this point forward. Rather, they've held back on issuing proposed regulations that would eventually go permanent in this area. Now, this concludes this week's podcast on this. I want to tell you that the materials, as always, are available on my website. If you go to ezollers.libsyn.com, there'll be a link to the PDF file that has a printed version of these you may want to refer to while listening to the podcast. Also, in my printed materials now, I've started putting a list of the scheduled live courses I'm going to be presenting coming up this year. This year, I'm presenting for a number of state CPA societies. I've already presented for the state of Arizona an 8-hour course on tax practice and ethics. I'm going to be doing a 2-hour course on running Vista and XP on the same computer coming up this Wednesday. So if you hear this early in the week, and you're in Arizona, you're going to be in the Phoenix area, and you want to come by on Wednesday morning to the State Society office, you can sign up and take that course for 2 hours of credit. And I'll be doing a discussion in the Arizona Federal Tax Institute Annual Tax Conference, a discussion on preparer penalties. That comes up November 6th and 7th. I will be talking the afternoon of November 6th, will be my time. Also during this year, I will be giving full-day presentations in California, Maryland, Minnesota, Missouri, Ohio, Oregon, And I'll be giving part-day presentations, two half-day presentations. I'm scheduled to on December 17th in North Carolina. And I'm scheduled to give the technology update this year again at the Virginia Accounting Auditing Conference in both Roanoke and Virginia Beach. So if you have access or you live in one of those states, and I should say, oh, I left off one state here in my list. I'm doing a full-day presentation for the Wyoming Society of CPAs on October 17th as well in Casper. So if you live in one of those states and you want to consider attending one of the courses, I invite you to come by. I have a number of topics, different topics in different states. My topics for the year, I do a number of presentations on partnerships. I do a couple of presentations on S corporations. Fringe benefits are also one I do a few times, and I do a couple of presentations on current federal tax developments, various other issues along with the technology information that I'm doing. So if you're in one of those states, consider signing up. Check your state society calendars. The one coming up most quickly for full days is going to be 2 days in St. Louis on October 13th for IRS practice and procedure and October 14th for the partnerships course. This has been the Tax Update. As always, it's brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Consider visiting them and signing up for their email newsletters of items of interest to tax practitioners. This has been the Tax Update.